it would be helpful to recall the key points of his speech in chapter 4. The key points being the following two. Firstly, Eliphaz and his companions acknowledged that the righteous occasionally do suffer calamities. That cannot be doubted in any way. The righteous as well as the unrighteous do suffer calamities. That's a given. But according to Eliphaz, when a string of awesome calamities befalls a person, then that person surely must be guilty of appalling but perhaps secret sin. Why so? Because according to Eliphaz, this is in keeping with the nature of a just and holy God. The implication of this argument is what is significant for us. The implication of this argument, if Eliphaz is totally right, the implication is that despite his protestations of innocence, Job was guilty of secret sin, which he therefore had to confess to God in order to be delivered. The second key point from chapter 4, Eliphaz's discourse, is this. Eliphaz charges that Job's piety, his brand of religion, had been sustained by the expectation of material reward. That being the case, when he lost all his material possessions, when he lost his 10 children, then you know that he ended up cursing the day of his birth. He was shaken to the core because his religion was founded on receiving material blessings. So while he had a string of blessings from God, he was comfortable, he was in the comfort zone, and he could practice his religion with outward zeal. But when the time of testing came, according to Eliphaz, and calamity after calamity befell him, what did Job do? He ended up cursing the day of his birth. That is a significant action because although it does not amount to cursing God to the face, which would have been the end of Job, it is tantamount to implicating God as the cause, the ultimate cause of his, Job's, undeserved sufferings. So these are the two key points from chapter 4. To sum up in the form of an implication statement, according to Eliphaz, whenever there is a string of calamities, it implies hidden sin. Is this uniformly true? Is it perhaps sometimes true? Or is it always false? You'll recall that Eliphaz was induced to foist this opinion upon Job largely because of a supernatural visitation that he had received prior to starting out on his message. So the spirit being which we concluded last week was a demonic spirit, and given the stakes, it may well have been Satan himself. The message of the demonic spirit was that indeed calamity implies hidden sin, therefore Job is guilty, therefore there is no hope for Job. And it is that conclusion which is so devastating to Job, would be so devastating to Job. There is no hope for you because there has to be some awful sin hidden in your life for God to punish you, a just and holy God to punish you with this string of calamities. In giving this kind of counsel, you will recall from our discussion last week that the demonic spirit that visited Eliphaz at night was able to manipulate very easily the mind of Eliphaz. And through Eliphaz, who was the leader, de facto leader of the group of three, the evil spirit was also able to manipulate the minds of Bildad and Zophar. Manipulate them to do what? To convey to Job a message of despair. This is the key to the whole issue. If there is no hope for Job, really, he might as well curse God and die. It is such a cunning, but such a logically smooth argument that it is very hard to counter. It cannot be countered by human reasoning. One has to go beyond the dimension of human reasoning to rebut this kind of argument, because on the face of it, it is an impregnable truth. If calamity implies hidden sin, then the fact that the calamities have continued means that there is really no hope for you, because God is just. That kind of argument, how do you negate? You have to go beyond the dimension of human reasoning to rebut this argument. But Eliphaz and his friends are not at the stage when they can do this. It will end up with Job himself having to demolish this argument towards the end of the book. The intriguing question is this: how come the demonic spirit that visited Eliphaz was able so easily to manipulate his mind? Because don't forget that Eliphaz was highly regarded as a man of great wisdom. The Bible, in fact, refers to the people of Teman, from which he came, as being people renowned in the ancient world for their wisdom. So how could a man, mature, seasoned, and full of wisdom, how could he have lent his mind to be so easily manipulated? And if we attempted to judge Eliphaz, we should stop and ask ourselves, if he was wise, aren't we wiser? We have the benefit of the full revelation of God and the experiences of all the saints recorded for us. So Eliphaz was wise, the people of true life are even wiser. So if you were in his shoes, would you really have reacted differently? To answer that question, we have to consider the implication of Job's continued protestations of innocence. And that will give us a clue as to why Eliphaz and his friends were so easily manipulated by the demonic spirit. Job consistently said, "I am innocent. I don't care what you say. I am truly innocent." If he was correct, if Job's present afflictions and his losses were totally unrelated to his present or to his personal sin, so in other words, if Job is correct and there is really no relation to what I am suffering and my sin, there's no relation at all, and he was right in that, if that is true, then, and this is a frightening thought for Eliphaz and his friends, then the three of them, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, who were themselves wealthy and highly regarded in their own hometowns, were liable or susceptible to being struck down in the same manner as Job. Because this is logically such a simple equation. If God were to govern the world this way, he would have a very easy task. All of us have sinned, so all God has to do is to punish us according to our present sin. Small sin, small punishment. More grievous sin, more painful punishment. It will be really easy for God to govern the world of human beings if that equation were true. But if Job were correct, then there are many cases where there is no connection at all between the afflictions that one suffers and one's personal sin. There may even be a complete lack of personal sin at a given point in time, and yet that person may suffer a string of calamities. If there is no such connection, then it implies that anyone and everyone is susceptible to being struck down in the same manner of Job. Given this situation, it is no wonder that the demonic spirit was able to manipulate the minds of the three friends of Job. And don't forget, the objective of the demonic spirit in manipulating the minds of Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar was to press Job to the point where he would, in desperation, curse God and die. That was, if you like to think of it, the basis of the wager between Satan and God. But there is a flaw in the reasoning of Eliphaz, and there is in the message of his supernatural visitor a very terrible deception, which is very cunningly concealed. It is true, and this is the scary part about it, what the demonic spirit impressed upon Eliphaz, and what Eliphaz himself said to Job, on the face of it is true. What are they saying in quoting this relationship, that calamity is an indicator of hidden sin? It is true that man's righteousness is as filthy rags. No doubt about it, God himself has said so. But the conclusion that the demonic spirit induced Eliphaz to draw is a highly questionable one. Man's righteousness is as filthy rags. Therefore, according to the spirit, man himself is worthless. Pause for a moment and consider the implication of that point. Is it true? The first part of it is indeed true. Man's righteousness is as filthy rags. But does that mean that man, therefore, in his personal being, is a worthless creature in God's sight? Yes or no? Jenny shakes her head. And she's right. Because what the demonic spirit and Eliphaz tried to convey to Job is actually an egregious misrepresentation of the character of God. Man's righteousness being worthless does not ever mean that man himself is worthless. How do we know this? It cannot be just your opinion or mine. How do we know that man is not worthless in the sight of God, despite the fact that he is a sinner from the day of his birth to the day of his death? How do we know that man is precious in the sight of God? Because God so loved sinful man that he gave his only begotten Son to bear man's sins on the cross once and for all, so that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. as John 3:16 paraphrased. And if you need more proof of the fact that there is not necessarily a connection between the calamities one experiences and hidden sin, there often is a connection, but there is no, as we say in logic, there is no necessary connection between calamity and hidden sin. Second proof, if proof is needed, is to be found in John chapter 9, reading from verse 1 through verse 3, John 9, 1 through 3. And as Jesus passed by, he saw a man which was blind from his birth, and his disciples asked him, saying, Master, who did sin, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Jesus answered, Neither has this man sinned nor his parents, but that the works of God should be made manifest in him. And this passage beautifully sums up the case of Job. Job was put through these afflictions, cycles of affliction of increasing severity, so that the works of God might be made manifest in him. With that preparation, we can move on to chapter 5, which is a continuation of the discourse of Eliphaz. Verse 1, Call now, if there be any that will answer thee, and to which of the saints wilt thou turn? The expression call now in the Hebrew is actually a legal term. What Eliphaz is stating is this: even if Job were to enter into litigation to defend his name, to clear his name, he would not, according to Eliphaz, be able to find a single holy one. That's the literal meaning of saints. It could be an angel, it could be a human being. Job would not be able to find a single holy one. In modern legal terms, a reliable witness to testify in his defense. Call now, if there be any that will answer thee, and to which of the saints will thou turn? Even if you enter into litigation with God, you will never find anyone, angelic or human, who could be regarded as a reliable witness to testify in your defense. In verse 2, there are some words that need explanation. For wrath killeth the foolish man, and envy slayeth the silly one. The word wrath is, in Hebrew, is ka'as. It has a variety of meaning, and that's why we have to be guided by the context. It can mean simply wrath, extreme anger, which I don't think fits the context. But there is an alternative meaning that to me does fit this particular context, and that meaning of ka'as is vexation of spirit, an internal agitation. There could be a component of anger in it, but it is not pure anger per se. So the best way to describe it is vexation of spirit. The second word that we need to note is the word foolish. In Hebrew, there are two separate words for foolish, and the particular word used here, evil, refers to a hardened fool. In other words, one who is so set in his foolish ways that he stubbornly blunders on through life, refusing to learn from his mistakes, and he just keeps going on and on. The third word that we should take note of is envy, in Hebrew, kinah. What is Eliphaz referring to when he uses this word envy? Envy slayeth the silly one. What he is saying is, Job, by you continually comparing yourself with others who are less deserving than you, but who are nevertheless enjoying life. You are making yourself a victim of envy. And that envy, coupled with what was said earlier, the vexation of spirit, is going to excite such strong emotions, create such stress within you, raise your blood pressure to such a high level that you are going to come to an untimely end. So that is what Eliphaz is trying to say. And the final word that we need to look at is silly one, pata. Again, there is a variety of meanings, but we must be guided by the context. And in this particular context, the only meaning that to me fits is easily manipulated. Wrath killeth, vexation of spirit brings the foolish man, the hardened fool, to an untimely end. And then there is the synonymous parallelism, envy, this continually comparing yourself with others who appear to be less deserving but enjoying life when you should have been enjoying life. This envy that results from such comparisons also excites in you the kind of tension and stress which will bring you to the grave earlier than you should. So in essence, what Eliphaz is telling Job is he's quoting a proverb of his time to this effect, that vexation of spirit coupled with envy of others who are enjoying life excites such strong emotions in oneself as to bring you to an untimely end. If you were Job and you receive such counsel, how much comfort would it bring to you? Remember, these were Job's closest friends. They had access to his heart. They were his inner circle. Every word that they spoke would carry an impression that would be far deeper than words spoken by mere acquaintances. Therefore, when Eliphaz, whom he trusted so much, spoke these words to him, Job must have been terribly broken and cut up. It reminds me of the case where a young, hoping to be married couple have their first session with a marriage counselor. They go there all expectantly, waiting for pearls of wisdom to be given to them, how to make their marriage a success. And the marriage counselor, a very experienced man, a pastor perhaps, looks at them, gets their background, goes through the routine, and then he says, "My friends, my best counsel to you from years of wisdom, please don't get married because you are living in the end times." It would be as comforting to them as Eliphaz's message to Job. It would break them. On to verse 3. "I have seen the foolish taking root." We need to explain that expression. But what is very cryptic is the second half of verse 3. "But suddenly I," Eliphaz is referring to himself, "I cursed his habitation." Verse 4, which is a continuation of that idea. "His children are far from safety. They are crushed in the gate. Neither is there any to deliver." Verse 5, "whose harvest the hungry eateth up and taketh it even out of the thorns, and the robber swallows up their substance." I don't know how you look at it, but verses 4 and 5 appear to be an oblique reference to the case of Job. After all, were not Job's 10 children literally crushed, as Eliphaz is saying? The children of the foolish are crushed in the gate. Were not Job's 10 children literally crushed? And with regard to the robbers swallowing up their substance, were not all of Job's flocks of animals, a major portion of his substance, or in modern financial terms, a major part of his portfolio is stolen. This is really a very uncharitable act of Eliphaz. Job was already down and he was hitting Job below the belt. Now back to that cryptic second half of verse 3. I have seen the foolish taking root, but suddenly I cursed his habitation. The first thing to note is this. In all of Eliphaz's speeches, they are peppered with the frequent use of the personal pronoun. I observed this. I saw this. In other words, Eliphaz is appealing to personal direct observation. He is not just citing authorities or tradition. He is citing his personal observation. I saw it with my own eyes. And typically, that kind of evidence carries more weight than merely citing an authority, because authorities have been known to differ from one another and to be wrong in many cases. That is how specialists misdiagnose the symptoms of a disease and tell you you have cancer of the ear, when you know that your ears are perfectly healthy. But personal observation, I have observed it, I have done it, carries more weight. So in giving the advice to Job, in giving Job his so-called pearls of wisdom, Eliphaz is buttressing his speeches with appeals to his personal observation. And in doing that, he is actually practicing the maxim penned by Alexander Pope in 1733 in his long poem Essay on Man. Know then thyself, presume not God to scan, the proper study of mankind is man. So Eliphaz is saying, look, in the course of my life I've made a special practice of studying my fellow men. That's how I know so much about human nature. And I'm telling you now, Job, you have no hope because you have secret sin in your life. That is his argument. Now we have to look at the phrase taking root, sharash in Hebrew. This figure of speech is often used in the Bible to denote two things that go together: stability with prosperity. Not just prosperity, not just stability, but stability with prosperity. And a good supporting verse to refer to is Isaiah 27 and verse 6. Isaiah 27 verse 6. He, Jehovah, shall cause them that come of Jacob to take root. Israel shall blossom and bud and fill the face of the world with fruit, which really is stability with prosperity. The tricky part is what follows immediately in verse 3. Suddenly I cursed his habitation. Although these folk lived early in the patriarchal age, where the head of the household literally had the power to bless or to curse, Eliphaz in this verse 3 is not claiming to have cursed the fool that he had been observing. What he means to say is the prosperity of more than one morally deficient man that he had observed was reduced to dust. And in that regard, the man, the fool, and his household could be regarded as cursed by God. So remember, Eliphaz is not claiming to have cursed the fool, but he's saying that I have observed in most cases those who are foolish end up losing everything, and in that regard, and even their families suffer as a result, in that regard, you can tell in advance. In other words, Eliphaz is saying, If you encounter in your observation a foolish man, you can conclude, it's almost like a law of nature, you can conclude that eventually that man and his family are going to be reduced to the dust. It's a very gruesome statement to make, and really it is flawed, because Eliphaz is claiming that whenever, and the key word is whenever, whenever a man's prosperity is suddenly brought to naught, it is a sure indicator of secret sin. We have to be very careful here, because there are scripture passages that on first reading appear to support Eliphaz. To recap, Eliphaz is saying that whenever a man who is healthy, wealthy and prosperous, and a religious man at that, whenever he suffers a string of calamities, then it's a sure indicator that there is secret sin in the life of that person. There are scripture verses that on the face of it appear to support that position, which is why we need to be careful. Consider, for example, Psalm 37, and let me read to you verses 35 and 36. Psalm 37, verses 35 and 36. I have seen the wicked in great power and spreading himself like a green bay tree. The idea here of the green bay tree is that of a tree that grows to full maturity in the original soil in which it was planted and is never transplanted during the course of its life. Unlike the rain trees which were grafted and then taken out of the nursery and planted along the ECP, the green bay tree is so very healthy and stable because it is never transplanted. It continues to grow to maturity in the soil in which it was originally placed. I've seen the wicked in great power and spreading himself like a green bay tree, yet, verse 36, he passed away. And lo, surprise, surprise, he was not. Yea, I sought him, but he could not be found. If you read these two verses and take them out of context, they do support what Eliphaz is claiming, that great calamity surely means great sin. On the face of it, these two verses from Psalm 37 appear to support Eliphaz. But it is always the context that determines the final meaning. And the context of verse 37, taken as a whole, of Psalm 37, taken as a whole, cannot support that interpretation of just these two verses. To counter what Eliphaz was trying to say, and again quoting scripture, we have looked at Psalm 37. Now we look at Psalm 73 and see what Psalm 73 has to say. I will read from the second half of verse 3 and then on to verse 4, verse 5, jump to verse 7, and then jump to verse 12 and end with verse 13. Psalm 73. I, meaning Asaph, the writer, saw the prosperity of the wicked, for there are no bands in their death, but their strength is firm. They are not in trouble as other men, neither are they plagued like other men. Their eyes stand out with fatness, they have more than heart could wish. Behold, these are the ungodly who prosper in the world. They increase in riches. Verily, I have cleansed my heart in vain and washed my hands in innocency. What Asaph, the writer of this psalm, is saying is, seeing this state of apparent injustice in the world, I was really led to toy with the solution, since I can't beat them, why don't I give up my attempts to be righteous and just join them and enjoy the blessings of a good life here on earth. So the lesson to learn from this is, in citing scripture passages to support a position, particularly a position that is inferred and not literally stated, we have to be very sure that the original context of those verses will support your interpretation. Now back to Job. Verse 6. Although affliction cometh not forth of the dust, neither does trouble spring out of the ground, yet man is born unto trouble as the sparks fly upward. These two verses are often quoted but seldom properly understood. So we shall try here to address the issue. In verse 6, affliction cometh not forth out of the dust, dust neither does trouble spring out of the ground. Eliphaz posits that afflictions do not come upon a man out of nowhere, out of a vacuum. The seeds of that affliction had to have been sown earlier by the person concerned. And even if that were not the case, man, being a sinner by his very nature, is bound to suffer afflictions and heartaches. And we are reminded of this by the succinct answer to question 16 of the Shorter Catechism. The covenant being made with Adam, not only for himself but for his posterity, all mankind descending from him by ordinary generation, sinned in him, that is Adam, and fell with him in his first transgression. And because of this sin nature, even if you are not guilty of specific sin, God is entitled legally to send all manner of trials and afflictions upon you, because you in the 21st century are directly implicated in the fall of Adam so very long ago. Not surprisingly, therefore, man is born unto trouble. What Eliphaz is saying is this, to put it in another way: man is caught in an unbreakable chain of sin coupled with chastisement, and there's no way in this earthly life to break free from this chain. Therefore, he counsels Job, please stop whining about your condition. Please stop crying out for justice. This is, after all, the lot of every human being. Why don't you just shut up and bear it and pray? And in God's good time, he will either take away your life or he will restore you. You know, sometimes we unwittingly mean well when we counsel a person in need. And we usually listen. We know that one of the first hallmarks of a good counselor is a listening ear. So we listen to the person pouring out his or her complaints and trials and worries. And in doing so, that person is obviously looking to you as someone stronger, more experienced, not only to give a listening ear or lend a shoulder to cry upon, but to give advice and guidance. And it is no help at all for you to listen to all of this and then turn around and very sweetly tell the person, just pray about it. It is true, we need to pray. But at that point in time, is that all you can say to the person in need? Just pray. The person knows that. But what he or she is looking for is practical advice from a godly person like yourself. So we need to learn from Eliphaz to be very careful about giving universal or sweeping statements and foisting them onto people in need, because that is not going to comfort and counsel them. It's going to drive them further from you. So this counsel of Eliphaz to Job, just shut up and accept your lot in life and stop whining, is not going to be of any comfort to him. But Eliphaz does offer a constructive suggestion. He says, look, Job, all is not lost. Whatever I've said is true because I, Eliphaz, have observed it. I'm a man of great wisdom and knowledge. Whatever I've said is true. But don't give up. You can always turn to God and commit your case to God because God is just. And this, in essence, is the thrust of his message in verses 9 through 16. In verse 8. And then in verses 9 through 16, Eliphaz gives what is a very orthodox depiction of the greatness, wisdom, and mercy of Jehovah. Eliphaz in verses 9 through 16 also presents Jehovah as a friend and protector of the defenseless. Thus, says Eliphaz, there is still hope for you, Job, because even though God is a God of justice, even though God is punishing you right now, he is also the friend and protector of those who are defenseless like yourself. So you do have hope. Don't give up. And this sentiment, whatever we may think of Eliphaz, is actually correct. It is in harmony with many other passages in Scripture. And I give you just two for your reference. Psalm 107, verses 41 and 42. Psalm 107, 41 and 42. Yet setteth he, Jehovah, the poor on high from affliction, and maketh him families like a flock. The righteous shall see it and rejoice, and all iniquity shall stop her mouth. That is verses 9 through 16. Echoed by Psalm 107, verses 41, 42. And then in verses 17 through 26, Eliphaz changes tack and counsels Job to submit meekly to the chastening of Jehovah, who after all has only the good of Job in mind. And in this counsel also, he is very orthodox. What he says is consonant with the rest of Scripture. Submit yourself when you are in affliction to the mighty hand of God, and he will deliver you. This is a sentiment that is shared by many other inspired writers of Scripture, Proverbs 3:11-12, which is echoed in Hebrews 12, verses 5 and 6, and is also mentioned in James chapter 1, verse 12. The book of Job, chapter 5 of the book of Job then ends with verse 27. Lo this, we have searched it, so it is. Hear it, and know thou it for thy good. Eliphaz states again that close observation over the course of his life has shown him the workings of divine providence and has enabled him from his vast experience to understand, to comprehend the principles of divine government. So there is affliction and suffering in this world. It falls upon the wicked as well as the righteous. And if it falls upon you as a righteous person, just submit yourself to God and pray. He will deliver you. Lest we are tempted to judge Eliphaz and his friends in an unfavorable light, we have to remember this. No matter what flaws we may find in the way, in the manner in which Eliphaz addressed himself to the task of comforting Job, much of what Eliphaz says is actually true. It is consonant with the rest of Scripture. And when you consider that these folk lived early in the patriarchal age, they had no access to written revelation to guide them. It is remarkable, and to their credit, that they had this much of an understanding of God and of his ways in dealing with man. So we end by not thinking badly of Eliphaz and his friends. What they said in essence is largely true. There were flaws in their reasoning, but we can excuse them for it because they had so little revelation from God. That brings us to the end of chapter 5, and in chapter 6 we will encounter Job's first rebuttal. See you next week then.